Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey, everybody, I'm Michael Steele. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Always a treat when you're in the neighborhood. So I'm excited about our conversation today, as I am with all of them. But, you know, every once in a while, you just like to sort of settle down with an old friend and kind of chat about some stuff. That would be Keith Boykin, TV and film producer, national political commentator. He's a New York Times bestselling author, former White House aide to President Bill Clinton. He's going to drop by, and we're just going to cover sort of an array of conversations around certainly what's going on with the economy and SV Bank. We're going to get a little bit into the conversation around the shifting tides politically between Mike Pence and Donald Trump and the evolving presidential race. We'll also get into what's happening in my home city of D.C. and the realities that, Democrats and Republicans have a problem when it comes to D.C. So we'll get into that. It's a lot that we're going to talk about. I'm glad you could be a part of the conversation. Keith brings a wealth of experience, having taught at American University, the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University and City College of New York. He's also the co-founder and first board president of the National Black Justice Coalition. It's just a well-rounded conversation. I think you'll enjoy it. So stay tuned and sit back and get ready for a great conversation with Keith Boykin right after this on the Michael Steele Podcast. Well, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. It is always a treat when you get to drop in, especially when I got a brother I think you're going to really enjoy. As I mentioned, Keith Boykin is a TV and film producer. So that means he's like Hollywood. He's Hollywood. But even more so, he's a national political commentator and a best-selling New York Times author. Welcome.
Hey, Michael, it's good to be here with you.
It's good to be with you, Keith. It's been a while since we've been in person, but it's good to see you living large out there in L.A. doing this, baby.
Yeah, I'm staying away from the cold, I thought, until we got this rain out here, but it's all good.
Right. It's good. Well, I'm glad things are going well and you're behaving yourself. Well, there's a lot, man, to get into. And the beauty of it is you have commented, I've been following some of your tweets and commentary lately, given the crazy back and forth between SV Bank and the craziness with Ukraine right now, with Republicans, the DNC kind of shifting the political landscape. It's one of those things that I almost don't even know where to begin because it's all so good. It's all so good. But so let's start with sort of baseline stuff. What's your assessment as you're looking at the setup for next year, going into a presidential cycle? DeSantis now seeming to find some space, sounding as stupid as Donald Trump. And that's everybody's applauding that because they think, oh my God, at least it's not Trump. And Joe Biden seemingly navigating I don't understand why they're turbulent, but the somewhat turbulent waters inside the DNC with the idea of his possibly running again for president and really kind of proving the case that, y'all, I'm the best thing you got. So let's just settle up and roll. How are you assessing where we are right now as we come into spring?
Well, you ask good questions and set up the context very well. Obviously, I'm not an expert on the Republican side, but I've been watching Republican politics for decades now, and I don't see how anybody beats Trump. I think Ron DeSantis. I mean, Ron DeSantis, on paper, he seems like he's a good candidate, but so is Jeb Bush. You know, there's a lot of good candidates in the past who, on paper, seemed like they were going to be effective presidential prospects. But I think the party, the Republican Party, has become the party of Trump. And right. I've seen a lot of interviews recently where people were kind of getting tired of the drama and the baggage associated with Trump, but they still like Trump. And they think that somehow DeSantis can thread the needle and give them all the Trumpiness without all the Trump baggage. But DeSantis hasn't shown himself to be an effective political communicator outside of Florida, I think. And that's a problem. I think he's trying to test the waters now, but he's doing so in very limited capacity, going for this whole sort of anti-woke issue, which only resonates for the Republican base. It doesn't give him any broader appeal beyond that. Obviously, he's trying to appeal for the Republican primary, but it doesn't set him up for any possibility of winning in a general election. And I think at least Trump has shown an ability to do that, even without the popular vote win. So, if I were Republican choosing between Trump and DeSantis, it's kind of like, why would you choose the imitation when you can have the real thing?
Yeah, just so you know, Trump's going to pull that clip and he's just going to put it out there going, yeah, that's what I say. But you hit on a couple of things that I think are kind of interesting, and for me, kind of just really drive the underlying narrative. What is it about this woke crap that seems to just get white folks all excited, and I say that in a somewhat generic sense, because this is not just a hard right issue. There are a lot of, you know, Democrats and independents that I've run into who manifest that same pathology when it comes to CRT, general wokeness, trans issues, et cetera. What is it that is driving that in such a way that the Trumps and DeSantis types are able to create this wedge, which I think, yeah, could create a lane, or open a lane at least for a 2024 run?
Well, I think there's a long history, as you know, in American politics of fear of the other. I mean, it definitely predates the 20th century, but the 20th century, we saw from the 1920s and the 1950s, the anti-Red Scare, the McCarthyism that culminated in the 1950s. And then from the 60s onward, we've seen sort of an anti-Blackness, a fear of civil rights movement, a fear of difference. Recently, we've seen that it's been expanded since 9/11, a fear of Muslims, and most recently, a fear of immigrants. So what the woke storyline or narrative does is it plays on all those different fears: the fear of otherness, the fear of difference, the fear that these people are going to come in and teach your children to be accepting of drag queens and critical race theory and, right, and Black history and all these other things that strike people as being antithetical to the America of their past. The whole idea of Make America Great Again is based on this idea that there was some time in the past when America was a better country than it is now. But from when I look back at American history, there was no time in the past where people of color have been as included as we are today. So it's basically a statement they want to return to that era of the past. And that's a scary prospect for those of us who were not included in that time.
Well, you know, it's funny. You make me laugh on that one, because I am fond of pointing out to some folks who in the circles I used to run around in more frequently than I do today inside the GOP, who have this sort of mythological view of the 1950s. And they think that America was just at its nadir. It was just this wonderful thing, you know, between 1951 and 1959. It was this great moment, you know, white picket fences and, you know, car in the garage and pick, you know, a wife at home and kids in school. Ooh, And I like, you know, I told a friend of mine, I said, dude, the 1950s wasn't that kind of white folks either. What are you talking about? You talk to the folks in Appalachia, Mississippi, Alabama, you know, it's just like this notion. But I think what it really boils down to is they didn't have to deal with black folks the way they do now. They didn't have to face them. They weren't in my neighborhood. But my mom moved into our neighborhood in Petworth in 1952. Those white folks got the hell up out of there. They were gone. They didn't want any parts.
Yeah.
This black woman and her husband coming up in their neighborhood. So there was a sense of not having to deal with it. Race, the realities of race, others, as you well put it, like they do today. So they sort of have this view of a period that really never existed.
I think you're right about that in so many different ways. And I would even add another dimension to this too, is that the 1950s, aside from the race issues, it was a very complicated time in American history because it was a post-war period. Yep. The GI Bill was offering mortgages to middle-income white people primarily so they could move to the suburbs. They're offering college educations to people so they could help to pay for their college education. That was government welfare. It was government welfare that was supporting primarily white people at that time. But in addition, in the 1950s, we had a top marginal tax rate of 94% under President Dwight Eisenhower in 1950. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think people want to go back to that. And people are saying that at least don't want to go back to that. I don't even think Democrats want to go back to 94% top marginal tax rate. So I think that people really don't understand everything that happened in the 1950s and why we were coming out of that sort of that war era and trying to reestablish what kind of country it would be. And it set up the plane for the civil rights movement that began in 1954 with the Brown versus Education Board of Education decision in 1955 with the Montgomery bus boycott. But the thing that happened, and this is the thing that I always tell people, and I was just saying this recently about Marion Williamson, actually. Mm-hmm. The Democratic Party was a racist political party. I mean, my opinion is that all both parties were racist. And what happened is that in 1964, the Democrats essentially committed apostasy amongst the Southern Democrat faithful by Lyndon Johnson signing the Civil Rights Act. And in so doing, you know, the famous quote where he said, "We lost the South for a generation." Well, not only that, but it was a statement that the people who were white and Democrat, even if they weren't in the South, who related to the idea of having government involved in doing some things, didn't like the idea of government involved in doing things to help black and brown people. So it was, there was a transition that took place that after the 1960s. I saw Marion Williamson recently make a statement critiquing the Democrats' decision to move Iowa and New Hampshire away from the beginning of the primary mm-hmm. process. And she said the Democratic Party needs to return to its roots. And I don't understand the logic behind that. Having South Carolina at the beginning of the primary process is a part of the Democratic Party's roots, at least in the past 50, 60 years, because right. black voters are the most loyal constituents of the Democratic Party. Before that time, the Democratic Party wasn't really as kind to black voters. And they tried to sort of give lip service to that group, but they weren't really as supportive. The Republican Party historically had been the party that was supportive of African-Americans.
Yeah, that part of the history, that sort of changing of places historically, is a very interesting and dynamic process, because you begin to get a sense of the inner workings, or at least the inner thinking, of some Republicans who had made the calculation rightly that you could not win the White House, the presidency, without going through the South.
Right.
Because that's where the power base nationally was. It was in the Southern states. The Democrats owned the Southern states since Roosevelt. We had New England and the Northeastern, you know, sort of Republican establishment, which people still talk about today. And that's why they talk about today, because that's where we were anchored. But then you have this Nixonian view, really, which began with Goldwater, who rejected civil rights and said, no, we're not doing that. Johnson, who was, you know, a segregationist, embraced civil rights, pissed off the Democrats, It's exactly why, in fact, as I'm fond of saying, Kennedy went to Dallas to shore up the Democratic Party, which going into the 64 election in late 1963 was seeing some cracks in that base for Democrats. So he was going down to shore up and rally the Democrats. So you can begin to understand how these dynamics kind of played out. And you raise the point about the Democrats sort of taking the next step. And I think the way you put it is right. It is kind of going back, or at least recognizing where your strength is and moving South Carolina to the head of the line. How do you assess that playing out in terms of shaping not so much the 2024 cycle, but the 28 cycle, when Biden is out of the picture? And let's assume, you know, whether he wins or lose, it's going to be an open seat for Democrats in 28. Moving South Carolina up, putting Michigan in play, putting, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire somewhere else in the timeline, specifically Iowa, which everyone's sort of like, oh, my God, Iowa. How do you see that kind of playing out?
That's a great question. That, you know, it's hard in politics, as you know, to predict 6 weeks in advance, but right. 6 years in advance, I'm not sure I could even get close to that. A lot depends on who the candidates are. And one of the things I remember studying in political science classes back in college was the law of unintended consequences. Yes. It started in the 1970s when they changed the primary process, and there were all sorts of unintended consequences they didn't anticipate. Then Jesse Jackson comes along in 84 and 88 and changes the primary process again, the Democratic Party. And so I'm not sure we know at all what's going to happen. But I do know is one thing I do know for sure is that Black and brown voters in places like Nevada and Michigan and South Carolina will finally have more of a say in determining who will be the initial front runner instead of Iowa and New Hampshire, which are 1.9% and 4% Black. 4%, yeah, Black. So those places are overwhelmingly white. And that's not reflective of where the Democratic Party today. The Democratic Party is a multicultural, multiracial, multigenerational party. And the people who elect those, the party, not the spokesperson, but the standard bearer, should be reflective of that as well.
Yeah. And I think in a lot of ways, Republicans are kind of whistling past that tombstone at this point, thinking, better you than me. But if they don't adapt to the changing dynamics, it will be thee. I mean, that tombstone will be yours politically.
What do you mean by that? I'm not sure I understand.
Well, what I mean is they're looking at what the Democrats are doing with their upcoming primary process and going, not us. We don't need to do that. We're sticking with Iowa. We're sticking with New Hampshire. You know, because that's where our white base is. Primarily, that's what I remember having that fight inside the RNC when I tried to change the primary process and recommended that we go to a rotating or go to a different style of primary that sort of mixed up the opportunity to create more dynamics so that the cream would actually rise within the process. And got shot down. Iowa, New Hampshire would have none of it, and so forth. We were able to change some things with respect to the primary, got to add Nevada, because we only did three primaries. We did Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, and then we added Nevada in 2012 to the slate. Everyone thinks it's always been there. It's not. And we worked that out with the Dems, because the Dems had already had four states. So my point is the Dems have kind of led in this sort of reform of the reform within the primary system. And my argument is, if we don't look more creatively as Republicans at how to embrace the demographic shifts, that tombstone that the Democrats have planted and moved beyond, which is the old way of, or, you know, doing the primary, will be where we'll get stuck. And the politics are going to, I think, necessarily dictate, if not certainly by 28, I think that you're going to see Republicans kind of revisit this after this primary system.
I agree with you, because I think there's been a pattern in the Republican Party over the course of some time now, where they sort of criticize and disagree with what they call the Democrats' identity politics.
Right.
And then a few years later, they kind of jump on and do the same thing. I mean, I remember going way, way back to when Walter Mondale chose Geraldine Ferraro to be his running mate in 1984. And a lot of people criticized that decision. Some people thought it was a great historic decision, but a lot of people criticized his identity politics. When Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton ran in 2008, a lot of people criticized the Democratic Party for focusing on identity politics. And then what did John McCain do? He picked Sarah Palin as his running mate, sort of following suit.
Right.
We saw the same thing in 2006, I think it was. No, 2004, when Obama first ran for the U.S. Senate and all the other white Republican candidates who were his opponents dropped out. And they ended up choosing I don't know if you know him, Alan Keyes.
Oh, yeah, I knew Alan very well. Of all places. Yeah.
Why would you pick Alan Keyes from Maryland to come run against Barack Obama in Illinois, except for one thing? He's a black guy.
You pick the black guy to go up against the black guy. Yeah.
And now they're doing the same thing. Because, I mean, I don't know why Nikki Haley is running or why Tim Scott is running, but I don't honestly think that they have a chance of beating Donald Trump. And I think that they're actually campaigning for vice president, assuming Tim Scott runs. But I think they think there could be there's a good chance they could be vice president on the ticket as a running mate. And I think that's likely that Trump or DeSantis, if he somehow by miracle were elected, might choose one of them or someone like that, because they know that even though they critique Kamala Harris and the Democrats' identity politics, they know that this is a formula that they have to sort of begrudgingly embrace, even while they're attacking the Democrats for doing it.
Right. I would say with anyone other than Trump, the ticket for the GOP in 2024 will not be all white. So if it is DeSantis, he will have a Nikki Haley or a Tim Scott, because that's pretty much it. That's the water's edge. You know? You know, they're not calling me, so we know that ain't happening. So that'll be it. But, you know, I think you're right in that regard, that it sort of creates this pressure for the party to sort of, among a lot of other things, deal with the fact that demographically they're just falling further behind. And it won't be enough just to go ahead and placate by slapdashing some person of color on a ticket and thinking, see, we are DEI too. You know, after Ron DeSantis is now running his dumbass mouth talking about, oh yeah, the SV Bank implosion was because, you know, the bank did DEI, and since that's been happening, all these national banks have been incompetent. I'm like, okay, it just, that's the stuff that really pisses me off with people who know better,
right?
And when they use race so cynically. Look, I'd rather the day, and I'll put it in the context like this for you, Keith. When growing up, I had family in New York and family in South Carolina. I always preferred going to South Carolina. You know why? Because I always knew where I stood.
Yeah.
Right? They weren't hiding their shit. They were like, you know what? We don't like you Negroes. We don't want you coming into our businesses. And folks, I'm not talking the 1960s. I'm talking about the 1980s and 90s when I would go down to South Carolina. I have friends who still belong to all white country clubs, right? Back in the day. In fact, one of the candidates who ran against me for national chairman in 2006 was still a member of an all white country club and got embarrassed and resigned, lost the chairmanship race. And guess what he did immediately after losing? Rejoin the all-white country club.
Of course, right.
So at least I know what I got there, you know? You have these guys like DeSantis who put on the slick suit and they try to sound all-inclusive, but they are also at the same time creating these narratives in which they are very much antithetical to the idea, the cause, the interest, the history of people of color. And it's just so infuriating. And I don't know ultimately how it's going to play out for the party in this cycle. I can't wait if DeSantis, and I've already extended this invitation, and we'll do it again, Mr. DeSantis. If you get the nominee, please come to Maryland. I'd love to invite you to Maryland and to do a town hall at Coppin State or Morgan State University or Louis State, and sit down and tell these young Black people your views on CRT and wokeism and Black history and books that Black authors write. And we'll see how that goes. But it also, I think, Keith, opens another door, another side of the conversation, that you see this sort of elbowing beginning with Mike Pence. You recently tweeted out, I heard Mike Pence gave a speech criticizing Trump for the January 6th insurrection, but he's the key witness in the case and he's too afraid to testify against him. That's not courage. That's cowardice. I agree 1,000%, because don't sit there and tell me, oh, you know, yes, he put my wife and my kids and my family and the Capitol in danger. But then when the police, let's put it in street terms, the police come and ask you, could you come and testify what you saw witnessed at the scene of the crime? And you're like, you know what? I can't do that.
Yeah. You know, I think about 10, 15 years ago, there was a big debate in the public sphere about this no snitching code among people in Black communities. Right. The idea that if Black people saw something in a community in the Black city or Black area neighborhood, that a lot of Black people didn't feel like they wanted to snitch on the people who were committing crimes because they didn't trust the law enforcement to do something about it, to do the right thing about it. And I feel like that's kind of what we're seeing in the GOP right now, this whole sort of no snitching thing, you know, snitches right. get snitches. And I think they're afraid to go against Donald Trump for any reason. And the most cowardly thing of all is that Mike Pence is out here on a book tour, promoting his book everywhere, hawking that anywhere he can, goes to the Gridiron Dinner behind closed doors with no cameras, and then he has the courage to say that Donald Trump will be held accountable by history. Well, history doesn't happen by accident. It happens because people do something to make that history. I mean, exactly. If the Watergate committee decided to say, oh, well, you know, Richard Nixon will be held accountable by history, so we're not going to do anything, that's cowardice. The whole point of people who are in that moment of history is to stand up and do their jobs. He has had the opportunity repeatedly to do so and has declined. All you have to do is testify. If you can say it to the Gridiron Dinner, if you can say it in a book, if you can say it in your interviews on television, why can't you go and say it under oath to Jack Smith or whomever else is asking you questions for the investigation?
It's a fascinating moment when you find political figures who, in one sense, really have to confront their political mortality. In other words, that's the end game. Oh, if I say something, then the base is going to vote against me or they're not going to support me. And these are the same people who, for every moment up to that point, emphasize and stress the value of law and order, democracy, structure, form, all these things that would require you, right? When asked to help us get this right and do right by the right. victims of January 6th, the officers who lost their lives, the Capitol Hill police and staff who were affected by this, and mostly for the country that is screaming for something to be done and for someone to be held accountable, that these people just say no. They just say no. And then you've got the Jim Jordan sitting there talking about, we're going to demand, you know, when we submit these subpoenas that people show up. I'm like, dude, you got a freaking subpoena over your head right now you haven't responded to from the January 6th committee. What? So this double-sided view of the world, to me, is just, it's a fascinating piece of American politics today.
Well, again, I think this goes back to race in our country's history as well, because the whole idea of law and order as a campaign theme started, I believe, in the 1960s in the South. And it was designed not so that we could have equal law and order standards that everyone could abide by. It was designed basically to stop civil rights protesters and outside agitators, as they called them, anyone who was advocating for the civil rights of African Americans, or anyone who took it beyond that, the people who were rioting in the streets. But the law and order only applied to Black people. And I think that what the sad thing is, what I'm getting the feeling now, is that for a lot of Republicans, law and order isn't something they truly believe in. They believe in law and order in order to keep Black and brown people in check, but not to regulate their own behavior. And that's a very sad state of affairs about our country.
That's right. Because you know what happens if you don't regulate us. We go and do creative shit. Right, exactly. Right. Seem like stop signs and stop lights and, right, you know, split blood plasma and all that kind of stuff, because, you know, we can't do anything else. It just it's so annoying in so many levels. I want to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to learn a little bit more about the National Black Justice Coalition, which you co-founded. And the work that you're doing there. And I definitely want to talk to you about quitting.
Okay.
Which you seemingly know a little bit about.
Okay. All right.
We're having a great conversation with my buddy, Keith Boykin. We'll be back right after this.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. We are having fun with Keith Boykin, author, TV personality, New York Times best-selling author. you co-founded and are president. We're president. Are you currently still president?
No, I'm not. But I was a co-founder and first board president.
That's right. First board president of the National Black Justice Coalition. What was that about? What was the work in that space geared towards?
Well, originally it started because of this issue of marriage equality back in 2003. Massachusetts became the first state to legalize same-sex marriage.
Right.
And there was a lot of division of opinion about that in the Black community, but I saw there were a lot of African-American pastors on television who were condemning it, but there wasn't anybody who was really speaking out in favor of marriage equality in the public sphere. So we created an organization to fight both racism and homophobia in Black and brown communities, and also in non-Black communities and spaces. And so it really grew out of that, the idea of understanding the old axiom that Dr. King spoke of, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, mm-hmm. that we couldn't just be concerned about one group's freedom, but also about all of our freedoms. And so the organization has really grown from there. That was 20 years ago when we founded it. I'm no longer on the board or in affiliated with the organization in that capacity, but I noticed that they have now been involved in leading the charge against Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and the whole AP history, African-American history course, leading the charge to include some of the themes that were left out from the AP African-American history course curriculum that has been under debate recently. And I think that's important, that we have a history that includes all of us, because the history does include everyone. And right. It's important that we don't forget some groups as we talk about that history.
I had an interesting conversation. I always have interesting conversations with my buddy Jonathan Capehart of the Washington Post. And one of the conversations when the narrative around gay marriage began after Joe Biden's sort of hey, this is what we're doing now, and Obama's like, what are we doing? is how this issue has evolved in the Black community, which is why I wanted to focus on the coalition's work, because I tell me if I'm off base, but I would argue that it played an important role in sort of reframing the conversation around what it is to be Black and gay.
Yeah.
Because there was such a some would argue stranglehold on a conventional thought that this lifestyle, as some would characterize it, is antithetical to the Black community on so many levels. How are you going to tell your grandmama, let alone your mama and your brother, that you're gay? But the fact remains that there were a lot of gay people who are living that life and trying to live that life and find themselves. How has this changed? Because now when you turn on the television, this is my little side. This is where Jonathan and I still have a laugh, because I look at these commercials and they just, I mean, they are 90% two Black men or a Black guy and a white guy, you know, sort of having an intimate moment. I'm like, that just would not play 10 years ago, 15 years ago in a way that it does today. So it does speak about the evolution. Talk a little bit about that, particularly when you're now looking at almost the back end of this, Keith, with the anti-trans and the resurgence, certainly in the anticipation that the Supreme Court will shoot down gay marriage.
Gay marriage, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's so much to say there. I mean, I graduated from college in 1987 at Dartmouth in New Hampshire, and I went to work for Michael Dukakis when he ran for president and that ill-fated campaign. For 2 years, I worked for him.
I mean, hold up. Excuse me. You graduated college in 1987?
Yeah.
Oh, damn.
1987. And went to work for Michael Dukakis in 87, 88. And it was a weird experience for me. I was a press aide. I worked on the campaign plane, so I was with the candidate every day. And never once did I hear any mention of LGBTQI issues during the course of the campaign. It just never came up at all.
Right.
Then in 92, I worked for Bill Clinton when he ran for president. And suddenly the big issue of the campaign, it was sort of a subtle issue, but it was a big issue, was the issue of gays in the military.
Right.
And it became even bigger after Clinton was elected and he said he was going to follow through on his campaign promise, which he didn't do, but he said he would try. And suddenly this whole gay issue became front and center. But the thing is that when I graduated from college, the idea of gay marriage was unthinkable. The idea of a Black president was unthinkable. The idea of trans inclusion wasn't even on the table. There's a lot of things that people are talking about today that I don't think young people have any sense of just how impossible those ideas were to even conceive of in public dialogue, much less political spaces in the 80s and 90s. So then we get to 2008, as you mentioned, Barack Obama runs for president. At that time, he was supporting civil marriage and not civil unions, not marriage. But that didn't change until 2012, when Joe Biden became the first person to sort of lead the way. And then Michelle Obama joined in shortly after that. And then finally, Barack Obama said that he'd evolved and he supported marriage equality. At that point, Black community support started to change dramatically, because it had been slowly creeping up with the work that activists had been doing. But President Obama shifted the dialogue completely for Black community, Black communities, because prior to that, Black people had been overwhelmingly opposed to gay marriage.
Yeah.
And after Obama came out in favor of it, Black people came out in support of it. So it was a huge, it shows leadership really matters. You know, sometimes you think, one person can't do that much, and one person who has a voice or a bully pulpit can't really change things, but you really can. And I always encourage people, if you have a if you have an opportunity, if you have a platform, if there's something you believe in, it's not hurting anybody, by all means, speak up and use your voice for good.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on a very important point for me about leadership. It is why we see the level of rot inside the GOP right now is because of a lack of leadership. We have suddenly become a pro-Putin, not a evil empire party, as we once were under Reagan. Why? Because Reagan led us to, you know, not just to believe, but to act on principally that Russia was an opponent. Romney reminded us of that in 2012, got vilified for it, but Republicans stood fast with him, right? Yeah. Today, Romney's an outlier when he says that, and Putin is the play. And it's all because of the leadership that now decides to go in a different direction for crass political purposes, not the principle. And so you can make the case that whether it was Joe Biden or Barack Obama or whatever, there was a principle position articulated in such a way that that a growing majority of the American people felt more comfortable expressing their own personal agreement with that principle, and aligned themselves with that sentiment politically. And so what is really an interesting test now is what gets clawed back, and to what degree and extent do the American people allow a Supreme Court, for example, to claw that back, as they have with Roe. I'm still curious. I don't think the end game has occurred yet with Roe. I don't know, though, if voters will just get to a point where they say, well, that's just it. That's going to be the law of the land, and we'll just live in a bifurcated country in which these states are going to be pro-Roe, these states are going to be anti-Roe, and I just got to figure out where I want to live.
Yeah, this is complicated, and leadership does require sometimes taking positions that are not popular. That's what Dr. King spoke about too.
Right.
And before I get to the specifics of the Roe point, I do want to make sort of a side note here about leadership in the Republican Party. I've been saying for a long time that I don't think Mike Pence has a chance, and I still believe that. But I do believe, if and you can correct me if I'm wrong about this. Mm-hmm. I do believe that and this is just a new idea that came up within the past two or three days. I was watching something on CNN the other day, and I saw an interview. I think it's in Tyler, Texas. They went to this place. Mm-hmm. It's the Trumpiest county in America or whatever. And they interviewed people. And I heard several people there. A lot of people said they would not vote for Trump again. But several people said they would support Mike Pence. I was shocked to hear that. And I think, to me, what that states is that if Mike Pence showed some courage and leadership and standing up to Trump, that there is a pathway for him to stand not so much as a mini Trump or Trump imitator like Ron DeSantis, but as an anti-Trump with more authority than anybody else can speak, because he worked with Trump for 4 years. He could possibly navigate that lane and thread a needle and create a path for him to the nomination. I hadn't thought about that as a possibility, because I never thought he would ever do such a thing. But that to me seems like the only way he could do that sort of leadership. Anyway, getting back to your larger point.
I agree with that point. I think you're right.
Yeah. I think I don't know how far the pendulum can swing before people decide they've had enough and push back again. And I expected actually there'd be more pushback to the abortion decision from the Supreme Court last year in Dobbs. But there was a resistance, obviously. I mean, we saw that within the election.
Right.
The Republicans didn't pick up as many seats as we thought they would. They lost some of the special elections, in part because of the Dobbs decision. And I think, you know, the Republican Party has to figure out what it's going to do next, because the momentum hasn't slowed from the group of people in the party who want to ban abortion altogether. And I don't hear a lot of people talking about that anymore.
Right.
I don't know if the Republican Party is, what's going to be in the Republican Party platform in 2024 on abortion. Are they going to call for a national ban? Is that going to be popular? Is that going to work? I don't know how that works. But when you talk about marriage equality, affirmative action, and other issues that are up for grabs now, I think at some point something becomes a straw that breaks the camel's back and people decide this is enough. And I feel like the Republicans are teetering on the brink of that right now with all the sort of the anti-woke nonsense that Ron DeSantis is pushing.
Right.
I mean, how many different communities can you possibly attack before the numbers just don't add up anymore for you? When you're attacking LGBTQ people, you're attacking women, you're attacking African-Americans. I don't know exactly where they feel that they're going to get support from, unless it's just from straight white guys. And
yeah,
that's not a majority of the population, believe it or not.
Yeah. Last time I checked, you're absolutely right about that. And I think all of those points you've made are going to be, they're going to be churned through in the GOP because they have to be. The fight, I think, is going to be a short-lived one in the short term, simply because they want to get set up to run the race for 24.
Right.
But like I was saying before about reforming the primaries for the 28 and 32 cycle, this same fight that they're avoiding now is going to happen. And I think it becomes even more important and more deadly, maybe, if they lose in 24, because then there will be those who will point the finger at the Pences and the McConnells and others and say, look what you have wrought. And then there'll be those who will point the finger at the Trumps and the DeSantises and say, look at what you have wrought. And this will be the culmination of a battle, quite honestly, Keith, that has been sort of roiling inside the party since Reagan left in 89. Because when Reagan left in 89, the question was, who's the next Ronald Reagan? And the party never answered that question because Bill Clinton, but Bill Clinton kind of interrupted that process. And they never really settled on an answer. And they've been fighting that fight inside ever since.
See, I'm going to ask this as a question because I'm not sure. I always feel uncomfortable talking with you about Republican issues because I know you're much more of an expert on this.
No, please.
But I'm not sure that in 2024, if Trump loses, that Republicans would just accept that result.
That's my point. They're not.
I don't mean in terms of pointing the blame at some one person or another within the party. I think they would accuse the Democrats of stealing the election again.
Oh, that's a given.
But I mean, I don't think it's a given if DeSantis loses or if another Republican loses. But I think if Trump runs and wins the nomination and loses the general election, I don't know if they're going to start pointing fingers at anybody. I think they're just going to start saying the election was a fraud. And I don't know. And you've got people in place now in a number of states and more potentially in the coming year or so that could help to enable some sort of anti-democratic effort to stop the certification of the election, although it would be unsuccessful. But I just don't know how I don't get any sense that the Republicans are going to do a great deal of introspection after that. We saw this. Remember when they did were you in charge when they did the autopsy?
No, I was not in charge. I would never have done an autopsy.
Okay. But never they did the autopsy. And they thought that things were going to change. And did anything change after that? I mean,
but that actually raises a very interesting point. The autopsy did point to where they needed to change. Okay. So I kind of created the change. Reince knew this going into 12. But Reince undid everything I did. He deconstructed everything I built, the national networking, the deep dive into communities of color. So the reason why I was running around the country talking about hip hop Republicans was trying to set the narrative and reset the relationship so that we can at least begin to have some level of connection to what's going on out there and talk about it in terms that people recognize. He threw all that out. We get our clocks cleaned in 12. They decide, I guess we should do an autopsy to see what went wrong. I didn't need to do an autopsy after 12, after 06 and 08, right? Well, we got clobbered because I knew. I'm a county guy. I'm a state guy. I knew what was going on. So this idea of doing the autopsy is more performative than anything. And how do you know that? Because Trump came along and crapped all over it. First thing out of his mouth was like, oh, yeah, Mexicans are murderers and rapists. You guys want to do something with Hispanics, right? Anyway, but they're murderers and rapists. So this idea of the fight, for me, is something that is just, it's an ongoing thread inside the GOP. And my thinking, at least right now, and this is really where I was going with that, was that you'll have, if whether it's DeSantis or Trump or anyone else, if they lose in 24, that will be losing since 2018, right? So you will have, what, four cycles of losses, 18, 20, 22, and then 24. And that puts an enormous amount of pressure, particularly if, you know, you're losing in such a way that you're not even in play with the popular vote, right? And where you should be winning, places like Wisconsin and Michigan, you're losing. Texas, for me, Keith, is this close to becoming a battleground state.
I've been hearing that for years and years. I'll believe it when I see it.
But the folks who've been saying it for years and years were kind of speaking prematurely. You go back. Yeah. I mean, I've been saying since I was a state chairman in 2000 was that after spending some time in Texas and watching what the Democrats were doing there, what I saw was they figured out something to put in the sauce to get the voters to change their behavior, meaning they vote for Democrats, the Democratic mayors, the council members, the judges. Now, the statewide races are a bit more of a challenge for a lot of the reasons that the national races have been a challenge for Democrats and Republicans. It's a matter of getting the right formulation of voters. But they are there. In a lot of respects. And so I'm not saying that it's going to happen, but I'm saying they are closer than they've ever been. And when that happens, there's no way Republicans win national campaigns again. This is their truth they've got to confront.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And I think the demographics are definitely shifting. One of the smartest things I heard Nikki Haley say when she announced her campaign was that Republicans have lost the popular vote in seven of the last eight presidential elections.
Right.
So that's an indication that something isn't working. Fortunately for the Republicans, they have a clutch on power still because of the way the system works. But Texas is like, In a strange way, it's like Florida to me. And I know they're two completely different states, but they're both states that Democrats have hoped to take over at some point because of the rising Latino population. It hasn't worked for a number of reasons. It hasn't worked in Florida in part because the Cuban and South American population in South Florida is more Republican these days than we would have expected. But also, there are... Trump actually did not as badly as I would have expected him to do among Latino voters. And Democrats have to figure out what that's all about and how to make that work for the Democratic Party. Texas is different because yes, you have Democratic mayors in Houston and in Dallas and places like that and Democratic cities, but at the statewide level, they're still electing Greg Abbott, you know, and how do you fight against that when they're even Uvalde, Texas? Remember what would happen? It was happening in Uvalde and the Republican controlled elected officials there who did nothing about guns. They still voted for those people. So I don't know. My heart keeps telling me, yes, Texas could possibly become a purple state or something in the future, but it just keeps not happening. It just keeps not happening.
Well, you know, all I say to folks is stick a pin in it let's revisit and watch it. It's just, again, for me, you know, part of my...
By the way, I'm actually more surprised and impressed by Georgia.
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't know if you ever talked to Charles Blow about his book about this, The Devil You Know, but I thought that was very prescient. I mean, the idea of like flipping the state of Georgia to the point where now we have two Democratic senators in Georgia. I would have expected Texas or Florida long before Georgia.
See, Georgia for me is actually makes more sense in the timeline, because if you look at the way it's flowing, it's Virginia, North Carolina, right? And you're coming around to, you know, Georgia, Tennessee, these states, Louisiana.
But why not South Carolina? They're 40, almost 40% black.
Well, you know? That's what I'm about to get. These states are kind of on the leading edge of this. I think what the Democrats did with putting the emphasis on South Carolina in their primary process will now just ratchet that energy up in a way, particularly given the level of voting, black voters, and their participation in the electoral process overall. My only point is, going back to what we were saying earlier about what the political landscape was for Republicans in the 1960s.
Oh, wow.
The yeah. key to winning the presidency was the South.
Yeah.
Guess what? Here we are again. It will be once again that key, as states like Georgia, North Carolina, Texas become less easily to count on. You're going to have to work. Republicans are going to have to work to keep Georgia red in a presidential cycle, given what they've been able to do with four elections now in the state of Georgia, right? With the spread between special elections and general elections. So that's all I'm talking about. When I look at the natural progression and order of things, I'm putting pins along the way, and I'm looking at the South. I hate to say it this way, but I will, rising again politically, to sort of set the new bar, for both parties, where it's not a lock necessarily for either.
Well, and also I think you're seeing a demographic shift, not so much in terms of identity demographics, but in terms of movement. People in this state in California are leaving. And lots of places in the Northeast, they're leaving. They're going down to the South because it's warmer and cheaper, lower taxes and things like that. But a lot of those people will be Democrats, too. And I think that's one of the things, you know, Republicans are bragging about, oh, we're getting all these new people coming in. But a lot of those people are going to be Democrats. They're going to vote for Democratic candidates. So it's going to have at some point, it's going to have an impact.
That's exactly right. So a quick round robin before I let you get up out of here. Sure. What are your thoughts on the latest anti sort of Democratic move with respect to my home city of Washington, D.C., where
the crime bill?
The crime bill got pulled. You know, a couple of things about this that I found really amazing, particularly with Council Chairman Phil Mendelson. So this is the deal, folks. The D.C. Council had a rewrite, some would say a sweeping rewrite of its of the city's criminal code, in which it lessened penalties for a number of crimes. That sort of set off a lot of alarm bells. Council member and chairman Phil Mendelson eventually announced withdrawal of the changes. But, you know, putting the blame on the Republicans, and I get it. Yeah, Republicans made a lot of noise, but, you know, Democrats are the ones in the Senate that said, nah, we're not doing this. The mayor, Mayor Bowser, was like, nah, this is a bridge too far. What's your take on the shifts that we see going on there?
Well, there's two parts of this. One is sort of the issue itself, the substantive issue of whether the crime bill rewriting made sense at all. But the second part is really what I'm more concerned about is the democracy part. And I'm glad you brought this up, because I had a debate, a fierce debate with a friend of mine who lives in Washington, D.C. He's a black lawyer, a progressive Democratic black lawyer, who was pissed off at the DC council, and he wanted the Senate to overturn this. He sent me a message saying, I'm glad they're doing this. And I was shocked to hear this, because I mean, I didn't even know the substance of it at the time, but I just felt like I don't like the idea of the District of Columbia ceding its authority to make its own decisions to the federal government. I find that very problematic, because once you open the door, anything could possibly happen. And so I know that Muriel Bowser, the mayor of Washington, D.C., was opposed to the city council change, but that's the way democracy is supposed to work. She vetoes it. They override the veto. People get a chance to vote them out if they don't like that. I don't think that the federal government should come in and make rules that overturn the decisions of the District of Columbia. If the voters in D.C. don't like it, they can get rid of those people. I just find it very, very problematic. And it's one of those issues where I feel like I may be out of sync with the Democratic Party or whomever,
right?
Even Black voters in D.C. But I believe in D.C. statehood. I don't think you can have statehood only part of the time, only when it suits your political interests. I think if you believe in statehood, you have to give people the autonomy to make their own decisions, right or wrong.
Well, I agree with you as a native Washingtonian. I agree with you and side with you on the substance. For me, it's about the democratic principle of the citizens deciding what's in their best interest through the officials that they've elected to serve, to execute on those interests. And when they don't, they can vote them out. They can have town hall meetings to challenge the decision. But there's always been this patronizing.
It's bad.
Yeah, exactly. Patronizing attitude from people who aren't from DC, who don't live in DC, who don't know jack about DC, coming in and dictating to district residents how they should live their lives and what is good or bad for them or what's in their best interest or not. Let them succeed or fail, grow or shrink on their own, not because, now I get it, DC is not a state. It's in a very unique spot. But that is the essence of what Home Rule was about, why that was fought for and achieved. And to continue chip away at it, to me, is just, it's problematic, like you said.
I'm going to take this video when this comes out. I'm going to send it to my friend in D.C. so he can see that you're saying this. So it's not just me. I felt like I was the only one who was saying this.
No, you're not. Yeah. No, I, in fact, worked on the first bill, the first constitutional amendment back in 1978 with Walter Fauntleroy. I was on his staff as a student at Hopkins at the time. And I spent a lot of time in D.C. working in his office. And that was the first piece of legislation I worked on to get it passed and sent out to the states, was the D.C. statehood bill. And that fight's been going on since the 1970s. And here we are. And everybody's got bloody fingers when it comes to why we don't have full autonomy for the citizens of the district. Even if you don't want statehood, at least give them full representation, you know, I agree. But we can have that conversation. So let's get some thoughts on your latest book, which I love the title, by the way, about quitting, why I left my job to live a life of freedom. What does quitting mean to you, man? I just thought that was so cool to just kind of say, hey, it's okay to just say, you know what, I'm done.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do feel that people have a responsibility to themselves. And a lot of times we get sucked up into the corporate culture where we feel like we have to give our lives to our employers. And if we're not there working overtime, working weekends, answering every phone call and every text message, we're not doing enough because somebody else will be competing against us. And I feel it's important for people to know that you don't have to live that way. I mean, you can choose to do something else. You can quietly quit, as people are doing, where you only do what you're required to do, or you can actually move on and do something else. You know, 40 million people left their jobs in 2021 and moved on to do something else during the Great Resignation. I think it's important for people to have that autonomy again. One other part about this, I posted something about this on Twitter recently because of the Meta layoffs at Facebook.
Right.
10,000 people laid off after 11,000 people were laid off just a few months ago. I always tell people, don't believe that companies are loyal to you. They are only loyal to the bottom line.
They're not, yes.
Exactly. As soon as they have a moment, an opportunity to make a buck without you, or get a computer or a robot or a chat GPT or something to do your job, they're gonna get rid of you. So you have to constantly be aware of that and not put your faith in a company to always support you, but to find ways to develop your own skills, to be able to market yourself, to be able to create new ways for you to survive and live in your own way.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. And I think the Great Resignation has had a profound impact and an ongoing one in the not just the jobs market, but in the culture of corporate America. I was talking with a friend of mine here in D.C., and he was sort of wringing his hands and concerned that, you know, he's got this office building that's only 60% occupied, right, downtown. Why? Because people are not going back to work. They're making choices for their mental health, physical health, along the lines of what you just described, because they realize, yeah, and the pandemic brought it about, but they did realize, oh my God, I can do something else, or I want to do something else. I don't have to do this way. And that sense of freedom of choice, if you will, for how I want to spend 8 hours of my day. Yeah, you know, it seems to be the interesting new dynamic that's changing the marketplace. I love the fact that here in Maryland, there was a bill that was starting to float, which came up and then receded. But I suspect it'll be back, looking at moving to a 4-day work week. More and more jurisdictions are doing that. Because guess what? That's what the workers are saying they want. I'm more productive 4 days and 4 days. That fifth day, dude, I'm living for the weekend. So,
and I don't think it just has to be a 4-day work week, but I just think giving people the freedom, and this doesn't work for every job. You know, if you have to be someplace at a particular spot and time to do a certain task, you can't do this. But giving people who can work remotely the freedom to do so. We don't all have to come in and give FaceTime to our bosses and employers just to let them know that we're there, when we could be effectively doing other things. Maybe we have a doctor's appointment. Maybe we have to pick up the kids from school. Or maybe we have to take care of our sick grandparents or something like that. We can still work at home and get things done without necessarily being in the office. And I think we should be, you know, as much as people talk about numbers and metrics, we should be focused on the results. Are you able to produce the results that are expected of you in this job? These are the numbers. Do you hit your targets? If you do, it doesn't matter to me whether you work in an office or on the beach, as long as it gets done.
That's right. That's right. Because, you know, hitting that target with a Mai Tai in your hand goes a hell of a lot farther.
And you're a lot happier. You're a lot happier.
Maybe the folks at SVB Bank should have thought of doing something like that. Instead of making crazy ass decisions about hedging against inflation and all of that stupid. Listen, man, I know you got to jump, but I really appreciate you coming on and spending some time with us on the podcast and sort of sharing your insights about business and politics and life and making it work. I really appreciate it, man.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to be on with you. Love the conversation.
Absolutely. I know you're going to head. I can see you're out in LA. You're going to head out to that beach and sort of grab that Mai Tai and write your next bestseller, right? That's how that works.
Something like that. Something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Keith Boykin, TV and film producer, just all around good guy, New York Times bestselling author, and the author of a book. Check it out, folks, because I really think you can appreciate where he's coming from about quitting, why I left my job to live a life of freedom. It's out now. Grab a copy and go to that beach with that Mai Tai and read it and enjoy yourself. Okay. All right. You can track and follow and keep up with Keith on Twitter at Keith Boykin. That's B-O-Y-K-I-N. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele, the podcast at Steele_podcast. Do that download thing because it makes me feel all yummy inside. I love it when you do. Share the link from the YouTube channel and from the podcast with your friends. The more the merrier. Until next time, be safe, be well, and don't forget your Mai Tai.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.